Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight. We venture out to the edge, a journey to dark and spooky places in pursuit of a greater understanding of our world and maybe of other worlds, other realities that seemingly interact with our own from time to time. The guests tonight are intrepid journalists, gumshoes armed with keyboards and cameras and courage. They put their careers and their credibility on the line to pursue truths, no matter where those pursuits might lead, in attempts to figure out who we are, where we fit into the big picture, where we rank on the pecking order, and maybe where we rank on the food chain. Charles Fort, the original Fortean investigator and journalist, wrote famously that he always suspected we are property, that Earth belongs to someone. And the implication of his research was that the landlord comes to inspect the property now and then to look around, see what kind of damage the kids might be causing. Covering this topic, this kind of topic, as a journalist is exciting, but it isn't glamorous. And a lot of the work is tedious and time-consuming, you know, pouring through paperwork, digging through documents in libraries, tracking down reluctant witnesses, trying to stay out of trouble with governments and other authorities, long enough to tell the story, assuming you can tell the story, whatever the story might be. You know, the risk of professional suicide is very real, given that the subjects discussed here on this program and elsewhere are viewed with great suspicion by journalistic colleagues. As with pilots and politicians, the pursuit of the unknown is not a career enhancer for mainstream journalists, which is why there are very few who do this full-time, who make a living chasing, for example, UFO stories, animal mutilations, abduction tales, creature encounters, government cover-ups. Those who can make a living at it are few and far between. Those who stick it out for a career are even fewer. Tonight we have conversations with three of the best, three rare storytellers who persevered and have helped us all to understand reality and ourselves much better than we would otherwise. Of course, Coast to Coast listeners are more than familiar with Linda Moulton Howe. She's been a contributor and correspondent for George Norrie for many years, reporting on strange and baffling topics related to science, the environment, medicine, and what some would call the paranormal. You know, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, Linda and I worked together on the same program. It was called Area 2000. Its host was a guy named Art Bell. That show became Dreamland, which became Coast to Coast. And our paths have crossed many times since then, sometimes chasing the same stories or at conferences or trying to land the same rare interviews. She is, I can tell you straightforwardly, fearless, and she follows the story wherever it might lead. This is a beat where it's tough for anyone to make a living. It's one that's largely dominated by men. That hasn't slowed Linda down a bit. I thought it might be fun for us to hear from Linda about her own journey, as well as about the topics and mysteries she's been pursuing all these years. So she will join us in a few minutes, and I think it's going to be a fun and informative. Then in the second half tonight, two more intrepid truth seekers. James Fox is a highly regarded filmmaker and television producer who is currently putting the finishing touches on a mammoth undertaking that is global in scope, years in the making. It's like the mother of all UFO films, at least in its reach and focus. And he has an experienced partner in this pursuit, Lee Spiegel, whose own pursuit of the UFO mystery dates back, I think, to the 1970s. I can't think of any working journalist in the country, in North America, who's been at this longer than Lee. Both of these guys have been my guests on this program in the past, but I wanted to get an update on their mega project, especially given all that is happening in the UFO world right now. They join us 2 hours from now, and I think they have some real nuggets to share. My reference to what is happening right now is, of course, related to the news that broke this past week, in case you didn't hear it. The news that's been dribbling out as well over the past 15 months or so. It started with a public event in October 2017, and not many journalists paid attention to what happened back in that month. It was an announcement about a new organization called To the Stars Academy, and a guy named Lou Elizondo stepped forward. First time any of us had heard his name. He announced that he'd been in charge of a secret Pentagon study of UFOs, or UAPs, the preferred term these days. 2 months later, the New York Times blew that story wide open with its account of ATIP, the Pentagon secret UFO study. Spokespersons have said that program ended years ago. It didn't. They said they don't know where those now famous UFO videos came from. They do. They said the DIA said it never oversaw any UFO or paranormal study. It did. Days ago, the U.S. Navy tossed a hand grenade into the discussion when it announced that it is developing a new policy that will allow its pilots to report UFO encounters. And the reason is simple. The pilots keep seeing these things with their own eyes. They keep seeing them with their instruments. The technology that has been demonstrated multiple times is beyond anything that is known or acknowledged, far superior to any aircraft in our known arsenal, able to do things that seemingly defy the laws of physics and aerodynamics, with no apparent propulsion system. They're of unknown origin. There have been so many of these encounters that the Navy doesn't want to sit on it anymore. They want to investigate. That's one of their top guys announced this week. Now, whether the public gets to see any of those investigations, that's a question we can't answer yet. But either way, this is a huge step forward for the Navy to admit that its pilots have been encountering these unknowns, that there's been an increase in the number of incidents, that they need to figure this out, that they want to make it available to investigate. That would have been unthinkable just months ago for them to say this. I think it's getting much harder for naysayers and debunkers and UFO nitpickers to dismiss this topic. You know, for the Navy, this was not an easy announcement to make. It happened, though, after some hard, jaw-dropping stories they heard from their own pilots about encounters that have been underway for a long time, but as we've reported here, have been on the uptick at least since 2015. You know, normally pilots don't say much of anything because it's not good for their careers to report they saw a UFO. And if they do report incidents, the information gets stuck in a drawer somewhere. It never goes up the chain. So it's been an eye-opener for the Navy brass over the last year or so to hear these stories for themselves for the first time. The man who is most directly responsible for that happening is Chris Mellon. He's a longtime staff member for the Senate Intelligence Committee, so it knows a lot of the people who still work there on Capitol Hill on black projects, secret stuff. He also worked for years at the Pentagon in the intelligence services and used contacts in both places, congressional contacts, military contacts, to begin a series of closed-door briefings. We've been hinting about this for the last year or so. Pilots would meet with staffers to talk about Tic Tac, to talk about the gimbal fleet, to talk about other objects and encounters, some very recent. Staff members then got their elected bosses involved. They say, hey, you got to hear this. The Navy has cooperated behind the scenes. They gave permission to their pilots to meet and brief congressional staff and congressional members. They've even arranged for transportation. It's been a willing partnership from what I have been told. And now this announcement this week. I asked Chris Mellon to give me a statement that I could read on the air for Coast listeners tonight. And he sent this explaining how this all unfolded. He said, some of his former colleagues were still employed there in Congress and in Capitol Hill and the Pentagon. So I was able to meet with him, I'm quoting him now, make introductions to Lou Elizondo and Navy personnel, and begin the process of revealing information that had been smothered by an indifferent bureaucracy since at least 2015. But the process only worked because first and foremost, some brave Navy personnel, both active duty and retired, were willing to stick their necks out politically and speak up. Kudos as well to the staffers who risked ridicule to do the right thing by examining the data and listening to our men and women in uniform. And finally, the Department of the Navy deserves our thanks, Chris says. They were very helpful and arranged transportation for the young active duty pilots willing to meet with congressional oversight committees. It's exciting. It's an exciting time. You know, we don't know where all this will go, but Chris Mellon and Lou Elizondo and some of their colleagues made it happen, and I can tell you, more information will be coming out this coming week, specifically related to the UFO videos that were released by the Pentagon. And I think every news organization in the country is now working on UFO-related stories. I think I read at least 20 different accounts about the Navy announcement in the last 3 days. International media, national media, and more are likely on the way. Maybe the New York Times will jump back into this subject. So with that backdrop, we have three experienced journalists to give us their take tonight on current developments, as well as their own individual journeys to get to the bottom of all this. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast website. Tonight, we feature one of the best print stories about the Navy announcement. It's from the Atlantic Magazine. Take a look if you're not up to speed on the big news of the week, UFO-wise. From that same publication, another piece, a provocative story about what if in the multi-billion year history of the Earth, there were other advanced civilizations that rose and fell long before humans came along? How would we know? A reporter tracked down the artist who created the creepy, unforgettable, oval-eyed creature that graced the cover of Whitley Strieber's classic book, Communion. It's an interesting backstory on how that image was made. Once you see it, you can't forget it. We have a report on metamaterials coming soon to a consumer product near you, and an unsettling story about Australia's war on feral cats. It's kind of complicated. I love cats, but this is kind of a sad one no matter how you look at it. That and more in Naps News, and while you're there on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. It's a great deal. If you've subscribed for a year, it costs you pennies a day, gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any device. You can also subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which is fun, covers a lot of the same ground as the radio show. George is out and about this year with his live stage show. You can find information on the website about where he will be and when, and we will also have more details on that later in this program. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat, and the ferret, and the tortoise. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those silky jammies and your toes into those bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in the Barca lounger. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Linda Howe and her lifelong pursuit of the unknown. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe is an award-winning TV producer, investigative reporter, and author who has pursued science, environmental challenges, medicine, and a lot of the topics that we discuss on this program from time to time, including firsthand eyewitnesses to high strangeness events. She's a graduate of Stanford University, where she earned a master's degree in communication, and is a longtime member of the Coast to Coast family. Linda, great to have you here.
Hey, George, it is good to be back. And I do remember when we were doing Area 2000 with Art, I think it was all the way back to 90 or 91.
Yeah, right in that neck of the woods, maybe 92, but a long time ago. And as I said, in a galaxy far, far away.
True. Well, I also thought in your very good introduction that I got a call from Tom DeLonge last Wednesday on the 24th, telling me that they were had been sort of helping the this evolution of a new policy with the Navy along, which is, I think, a worthy goal. And I thought that one of Chris Mellon, and you have to remember, he's former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence. He was the former staff director of the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And in this past week, he told Politico, quote, "Right now, we have a situation in which UFOs and UAPs, which is unidentified aerial phenomena, are treated as anomalies to be ignored rather than anomalies to be explored. We have systems that exclude that UFO information and dump it. In a lot of cases, military personnel don't know what to do with UFO information, like satellite data or a radar that sees something going Mach 3. They will dump that data because that is not a traditional aircraft or missile," close quote. And I thought, I wonder how much information and data beyond the Tic Tac and what was revealed in December of 2016 has been destroyed just because we've had policies of denial and actual lies since World War II and the Truman administration, saying that at all costs, the public and the media were to be kept away from the truth of an alien presence.
Well, Again, I would say it is just astonishing to me, and I've been at it for a while, not as long as you, but to have the Navy come forward and say this. Did you ever think you'd see it in your lifetime?
Because it's 40 years since 1979 when I did my very first interviews about the animal mutilations, and in the 4 decades as it has unfolded through the eyes of law enforcement and sheriffs and scientists and doctors and veterinarians who have told me the truth from their point of view, even if they couldn't stand in front of a camera and talk about it publicly, that we are dealing with an alien presence that is responsible for the animal mutilations. It is responsible for human abductions. Some of it has been behind some of the crop formations. And the list goes on. And so I have actually been feeling frustrated and impatient that we are now at 2019, headed for the middle of this decade. Or the next decade that we're supposed to be on Mars and the moon, and thinking we should have and should have had this headline. We are not alone in this universe. It should have cracked open long ago. And right now, George, do you feel the same thing I do? I think that that headline is close. I think it is going to have to happen in the next 1, 2, 3 years. If Elon Musk is serious about launching for Mars, perhaps on behalf of an agency to set up a base on Mars in 2022, then for us not to level with the whole world public, that not only are there alien presences interacting with our planet in this solar system right now as we speak, but they have been, as a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst who retired back in December of 1999 and sought me out through a man who worked for the World Bank, he told me, he said, our government has proof that there have been 3 competing territorial conflicting extraterrestrial civilizations manipulating, terraforming this planet for at least 270 million years. And when I said to him, what is the proof? He said, it's too dangerous for both you or me to tell. And I've often wondered what would be the definition of why knowing the proof of 3 competing civilizations in the solar system 270 million years ago, why would that be dangerous knowledge?
Well, I don't know the answer. I do know this is that it feels like a snowball rolling downhill, and I don't know that there's ever going to be an official announcement. I kind of tend to doubt it. Some sort of a hey, they're here, we don't know where they're from kind of announcement. But it in effect the same thing is happening, and the most dramatic development for me is the media environment has totally changed. The New York Times running that story made it acceptable for so many other news organizations to go ahead and dip their toe in the water. And the result is you've had since December of 2017, a heck of a lot of coverage. And now this Navy story, it's been covered basically everywhere. And that to me is huge because it gives politicians cover. It gives other news organizations cover to pursue it. And I think once you open the gates, the floodgates, you can't stop it.
Do you think that there is anything about this that fits into the category of conning the public and the media yet again because there is another reason for making these headlines, like a deflection moment, because something else is seriously being developed and they want to deflect attention? And I bring this up only because I got a fascinating email from a Navy personnel who said, I don't trust this announcement, and gave me some reasons why, fitting into the category of this Navy person knowing about UFOs and ETs. That's part of his existence on missions, but says that he is very suspicious about this announcement. If you were trying to analyze how this could be covering up other layers, what do you think?
Well, to fool whom? To fool UFO people? Because that's a pretty big step to take to fool ufology.
No,
Is it fool the Russians? Does it fool the Chinese? I'll tell you what, it's too big of a question to get in before we go to the break. So you and I will come back to that discussion after this break, and then get into your own journey, how you got on this path, and how it's affected your own life. We're talking with our friend and colleague and longtime journalist, Linda Moulton Howe, who's been pursuing strange mysteries and glimpses of other realities for a long time now, one of the foremost investigators of these subjects in the world. George Norrie, as I mentioned, is going to be out and about bringing his live stage show to Columbus, Ohio, Kicking It in Columbus, Saturday, May 11th, 2019, at the Lincoln Theater. He's got a bunch of special guests, Ghost Whisperer Marianne Winkowski, a certified hypnotherapist and paranormal mystery researcher, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Stan Friedman, the father of ufology, modern ufology, and a lot of other folks will be there. Got a meet and greet after the show and a live band and audience participation. It's a lot of fun. Got information on how you can get tickets on the Coast to Coast website. Back with more and Linda Howe in a moment, and we'll analyze whether or not Tic Tac, Gimbal, and other UFOs that have been seen in recent years and reported by military pilots might be an unknown aircraft that we've developed in secret. Back with Linda Howe. You know, Linda, like you, I've received emails from various military people who are trying to convince me that Tic Tac is ours, that Gimbal is ours, that these are black projects. Everybody's being misled. I have trouble with that from a variety of angles, and I'll tell you my take on it and then get yours. But, you know, when are they going to roll this technology out? Because Tic Tac was 2004. That's 15 years ago. But the same kind of capabilities, impossible aerodynamics, being able to bend space and time, that's been around a long time. You know, at least since the 1940s, these craft that have no known propulsion, that can appear and disappear, that can fly circles around our best planes, that can vanish in an instant, seemingly be two places at once, that can hover, that have no exhaust, that have no heat signal. You know, they've been reported in every culture and every continent throughout human history. When are we going to unveil this miracle technology and let the world in on it? If it turns out that this is a black project and that the U.S. Navy is appearing before Congress and telling elected members of Congress, allowing pilots to mislead them, there's going to be hell to pay.
And you're asking an excellent question, but I think that the pilot on the Tic Tac video, David Fravor, made a very strong point with John Burroughs and me a year ago when we did Phenomenal Radio with him for a couple of hours. And he said that when they took what was in the infrared and that they had, here's a quote, within seconds, Princeton, that was the ship, radioed the jet, that the radar target, that's of the Tic Tac UFO, had reappeared 60 miles away at a predetermined rendezvous point that only David Fravor and who he was talking to knew. And he said to me, whatever this thing was, it seemed to know exactly what we had just discussed. And of course, the implication is the kind of telepathic communication that people in the human abduction syndrome have experienced for decades, and knowing that something has the ability to access a human mind. And David Fravor even brought that up. And then further, when they did the calculation on those movements that were on the video and what were being discussed between the pilot and the control center, this is a quote, and even Popular Mechanics brought this up and analyzed this. A physical object would have to have been moving greater than 2,400 miles an hour to cover the distance in that reported time. And further, David Fravor told us that in one of those videos, they thought that the mileage could be more than 10,000 miles an hour, and that whatever they were dealing with over that period of time, they had the same phenomena that you just mentioned in the open, where there were rapid movements, perhaps over 10,000 miles an hour at some point, and that there were clean stop, 90-degree turns, and any of that would be impossible for a human body inside.
I'm with you. I mean, I guess, you know, the argument could be it's some kind of an advanced drone. But again, it's been around a long time. The same characteristics reported for a generation or more and throughout human history. When are we going to roll out this secret technology anyway? Because if you had one of these things, that's all you need. You don't need a great big Air Force. You don't need F-22s and F-35s. You don't need the space program. You don't need any of it. One of these, that's all you need. Case closed. Its capabilities are so advanced. So if we've got it and we haven't rolled it out, then someone needs to go to jail.
Well, and let's jump for a moment to a piece of hard physical evidence that to date has defied anyone on planet Earth even making it. And that's the bismuth magnesium zinc that, going back to April of 1996, Art Bell received a letter with some pieces of metal, and the person was an anonymous Army sergeant. And Art called me up and said, "I've gotten this. Would you start investigating?" And the first people I called up on what looked like the possibility of something that was aluminum, and the writer said he thought it was Alcoa Aluminum, and they did tests on these first pieces and gave me back a report that said that this was aluminum at 99.5% purity, and that this was not something that they would manufacture for any kind of consumption out in the world. And I reported that on what was then a Dreamland with Art, and within a short period of time, we got another letter. And a third letter came. He said, "There are other pieces that my grandfather pulled off the bottom of a wedge-shaped craft between Sierra Blanca Mountain and the San Mateo Mountains. In between is White Sands." And I've had other independent discussion about the fact that a wedge-shaped vehicle did come down in the White Sands near Trinity that might fit this particular case. And this second send of material was completely different. Silver, glistening silver on one side, pure black on the bottom, and what were clearly layers in between. And that began what has never stopped to this day, an investigation of what is this. And when it was examined by a scientist working with energy dispersive spectroscopy and other tests at the University of Michigan, it came back that the bismuth layer was almost pure bismuth, and that it was 1 to 4 microns, which is down in the nanotech layer, alternating like a tort cake with 100 to 200 microns of 97.6% magnesium with 2.4% zinc, and that these layers, pure bismuth and magnesium zinc, alternated up to about 30 layers, being not even quite a full quarter of an inch because they were so thin, but there were these many layers. And I still can remember Art said, "See if you can get to the bottom of this." And that one of the first people I called was back in New York City. And it was supposed to be an exotic metals manufacturer. And when I just simply was reading from the report I'd gotten from the University of Michigan about what this was made of, the man began to laugh. He said, "You can't put bismuth and magnesium together. They will never stay together. You'd have to put a bonding," and he just went on and on. Well, it's been through many tests. This is now 2019, 22 years later. And not only are those the constituents, but no one, George, no one between 1996 and April 2019 has ever been able to manufacture this alternating layer of pure bismuth with the magnesium zinc.
That's right.
What is it supposed to do based on several whistleblowers who have had some acquaintance with this metal during times at Area 51 and other places? They say it is only one skin of a parallel skin operation in the wedge-shaped craft, and that when the two skins are in parallel, that it will neutralize gravity. And I think you and I both, we've heard pieces about this for years from people who have been exposed and work at Area 51 and Provo and other places where highly classified research seemingly related to UFOs and ETs have been conducted. And some of those people, going all the way back to 96, I began getting first anonymous, that was letters then. We were not in the computer world as much. And this was first a hard letter to me saying, I am familiar with this material from research that I had done, and if you get this in certain frequencies, it will turn into a lifting body. Well, then what are we doing today? We are trying to investigate bismuth magnesium zinc with terahertz frequencies, because that has now come up. So my point is, for 22 years from an anonymous Army source, we ended up with material that over 22 years, it is still mysterious, it has not been duplicated, and it appears that if we understood what we're dealing with and how it worked on this craft from the late 1940s that was found on White Sands, we might have a revelation about how to neutralize gravity that would explain what David Fravor and other pilots since World War II for certain have seen: 90-degree turns, stop in the air, which would suggest there's no inertia and there's no gravitational, no gravitation to deal with in the pilots of those craft.
We're both hopeful. The world is hopeful that we'll hear some news sometime soon about materials testing that's being done. We know that TTSA, Hal Putoff, and some of his colleagues have been looking at that same chunk of stuff, trying to figure it out, and that Lou Elizondo has hinted they've made some progress not only on analysis of that piece, but other pieces. Jacques Vallée and Gary Nolan are doing their own independent evaluations of other materials that have been scrounged out of attics and drawers and hidden away in barns and things of that sort. Some Europeans are doing similar research, and I think we might be hearing some news about that. Now, Linda, you and I both know that even with a piece of something physical that cannot be made on Earth, that is beyond our capabilities, there will be pushback, and that some of the strongest pushback will be from UFO people, nitpickers, who don't want this to be true because it messes with their turf, because they're on the outside looking in, as well as the standard debunkers who think all this is nonsense and who don't want it to be true, the religious skeptics, a whole range of people who don't want it to be true, but no one more dedicated to denying it than the UFO people.
Well, I have never been a UFO person, ever. And my background at Stanford University, where I made films with the Stanford Linear Accelerator, that was my master's thesis, where they were just for the first time back in 67 to 68, trying to get computers to analyze the bombardment at the atomic level over at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. It was very labor-intensive, and my film was about coming up with computer analysis software that could look at particle bombardments and analyze and help humans save time. It was fascinating. And then I worked with the Stanford Medical Center. I did a film for them that they ended up using for 19 years after I graduated in 1968. And my beat will always, to me, from then to right now, this very moment and going forward, it has always been science, medicine, and the environment, And it is in that context that I came to investigate animal mutilations when I was director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver. And I started my very first phone calls and field trips in September of 1979. And my whole context for everything that I was doing at the Colorado CBS station was to investigate subjects that related either to politics, environmental concerns, scientific concerns in the state of Colorado. Well, by that September, there were literally hundreds of cases of animal mutilations in sheriff's offices all over the state. And I called up a sheriff named Tex Graves up in Logan County. He had been a sheriff for 23 years, was just retiring. He had done many, many investigations of animal mutilations, and he invited me to come up to where he was leaving the sheriff's department and opening up a store. And I got to spend time, because he was not having to do sheriff's duties, with him almost for an entire day. And one of the first things that he did was pull out a box of 266, because I counted them, color Polaroids that he personally had taken of animal mutilations from around 1970 or 71, and I was visiting him in September of 79, so about a decade. And he let me lay those Polaroids down on the floor in chronological order. And I will never forget a series where it looked as if this large steer had its head down in a hole. The legs were perfectly parallel and neatly put together, almost as if somebody had placed them. An ear missing, eye, the tongue, jaw, genitals, and rectum cored out. And yet, you could see clearly that the animal was ringed by maybe 20 feet of face powder dust, which happens in Colorado when you get into late August and September. And there was not a single track, not a rabbit track, and certainly no hoof tracks of that animal. It was surrounded by totally clean dust. And Sheriff Tex Graves said, the deputy and I, when we saw this big dust around this animal and that there were no tracks, I told the deputy, let's just take photos. Let's not walk into this yet. And so they walked around and took the photos that showed so clearly this head down in a hole that I was looking at in his new shop. And when I asked him about it, he said, when we finally had taken the photos and established that there were no tracks, and we got up close, he said, the only thing that we could conclude is that something had the ability to paralyze this large steer on that face powder dust ground and paralyze the entire body, leaving the head to move for reasons unknown, and that in the agony of the excisions that were bloodless, dry, without the tracks, the head had moved and dug the hole 8 inches deep that they measured with a ruler, from being paralyzed but having the head be able to move. And the sheriff looked at me and he said, Linda, I'll save you some time. The perpetrators of these animal mutilations are creatures from outer space.
On that note, Linda, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. When we come back, I want to ask you, you've done more work on animal mutilations than any person anywhere. And I'd like to get your current thoughts on why it's been going on and why the carcasses are left behind. We're talking with Linda Howe on Coast to Coast.